From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com. A number of North Carolina and American communities seem to be in a state of decline. We'll hear from a group called Strong Towns. It's working to reverse that decline. University of North Carolina President Margaret Spellings made a surprise announcement. She's leaving her job after less than 3 years. You'll hear her discuss the UNC system's accomplishments. A Duke University audience recently heard a warning from a left-of-center speaker. Don't let your activism get in the way of a good, tough liberal arts education. And we'll learn about the federal government's recent decision granting North Carolina a significant waiver. It will permit major changes in the state Medicaid program. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Governor Roy Cooper says that he wants to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 40% in North Carolina, and he wants to do it in just several years, by 2025. Now, his executive order describes his plan as a commitment to address climate change and transition to a clean energy economy. The question, of course, now is the governor on the right track or the wrong track with his plan? Don Vandervaart is the former secretary of the Department of Environmental Quality for the state of North Carolina. He is now a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. Don, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Give us your general sense, having read the executive order that the governor signed and which lists his goals and how he would go about it, your general sense of this whole thing.
Well, let's step a little bit farther back and understand that what he's talking about is roughly the same level of reductions that were sought by the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan. And modeling, so roughly 40%, it was I think 38%, but theirs was a 2012 baseline rather than 2005 baseline. Nevertheless, that level of reduction was shown, and the EPA at that time, the Obama and EPA did not dispute it, to make no difference in terms of global warming at all, over 100 years. And so the question is really, even if this executive order were actually followed out to the letter, what would it actually accomplish? But then if you step a little bit closer, you realize that the baselines that the executive order refers to were some 15 to 18 years ago. And so a lot of these reductions actually have occurred for various reasons: hydraulic fracturing, making natural gas cheaper, More energy efficiency technology having been implemented through some of our buildings, so it's not an unreasonable executive order from that standpoint in terms of practicality.
Because you're saying that the state has essentially met a good portion of this goal already.
Sure, we've already had a 25% reduction in CO2. Since 2005, we've had massive increases in energy efficiency in our buildings since the baseline that they named there of 2002. That's 18 years ago, some 18 years ago, 6 to 16 years ago. So that's a long time. But then if you step a little closer again, you ask, well, how is this going to happen? Because an executive order cannot authorize anything that isn't already authorized by law. It's simply a policy or guide for the agencies that the governor oversees. And so there, if you read the executive order, there are a lot of meetings that are going to occur. There are a lot of plans that are going to be developed. But at the end of the day, it's not clear how they're actually going to affect their goals.
Let's talk about a couple of the components that are in the executive order. There's the general goal, the reduction of 40%, which we've talked about.
Correct.
But the second item is this: increase the number of registered zero-emission vehicles individually to at least 80,000. Are we talking about electric cars here? Is that the deal?
Primarily, I think they're talking about a pipe dream. First of all, zero emission vehicles, all electric vehicles, are not zero emission vehicles, even though that's what they're
classified. They not?
Well, that electricity comes from somewhere, and that, okay. that electricity is generated using coal in North Carolina, coal and natural gas and some nuclear. So, yeah, of course there are emissions. There's no tailpipe, so you might feel better about it, but trust me, the emissions are occurring elsewhere. Also, they're not more efficient than gasoline engines, despite the fictitious numbers that the EPA has used in the past. Those have been shown to be phony, but that's what they're talking about. Now, how he's going to increase the number of registered ZEVs to 80,000, I have no idea, and I'm not sure it would do any good if he did.
One other thought on the issue of these vehicles is they run on batteries, okay? Well, as you said, there's emissions at a different point. But what happens when the battery, for lack of a better phrase, since I'm not a scientist like you are, goes kaput? Okay, when it's over and done, what happens to the battery?
Well, ordinarily you would landfill it. You could recycle some components at a cost. The actual mining that goes into the production is also impactful on the environment. So yeah, you're exactly right. You have to take a look at a cradle to grave type of analysis for those batteries, and the batteries are significant. You're exactly right. It's a significant component of a zero emission vehicle to be lugging these batteries around, and they're very expensive, and they include a lot of heavy metals and items that you do have to be careful about when you do dispose of them.
Don, I think this point is an important one whenever we're talking about this type of program is really to look at costs versus benefits. And what it sounds to me like you're saying is that this plan is put together and being reviewed or presented essentially in a vacuum outside of the other things that will occur over time. I think it's fair to say that all of us want to make sure that we're preserving our environment. The difference comes when we look at the ways to do that. So how do we save the planet, so to speak, but do it in a way that recognizes that no matter what you do, there's going to be a cost somewhere?
Well, the good news here is that the free market the restrained but free market is already taking care of this for us. As we said, there was already a 25% reduction. Folks are continuing to strive for more energy efficiency in their vehicles, in their homes. You're going to see these reductions occur. In fact, part of this, I think, is simply trying to take credit for things that are going to occur anyway. And you're, of course, exactly correct. You don't want these kinds of possibly regulations, if that's what comes from this, to actually thwart those efforts or make them more costly than they already are.
Now, one of the goals here in the executive order says we want to transition to a clean energy economy. Isn't that what natural gas has already been doing based on the free market?
Certainly my opinion is that natural gas is a far less polluting fuel than coal. Nuclear power is not even mentioned. It's a great alternative. The fact of the matter is that environmentalists now believe methane is a super pollutant because it is for whatever reason it's being used a lot more because it's cheaper, and for whatever reason they're now attacking it. I'm not sure that doesn't have something to do with the fact that the Russians, according to Hillary Clinton, have funded some of these environmental special interest groups, and it's not in their interest to see natural gas being produced. But yes, we ought to be happy about where our environment is. We ought to be thankful that because of hydraulic fracturing, we are able to clean up our power sector, and it's going to continue.
Lastly, Don, in our remaining moments here, if you had the chance to just talk with Governor Cooper, because obviously you know a lot about this and you have worked in state government as a senior official, you also have the scientific background, what would you tell him is the correct path forward?
Well, frankly, my question is are these resources being used to the best advantage? As I said, we're making reductions. Our power sector in CO2, our power sector is getting cleaned up. Perhaps there's some other issues in the environment that deserve this kind of attention.
We've been talking with Don Vandervaart. He is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. He is the former secretary of the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality. Don, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered. In print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Do you get the sense that American cities are on the decline? If so, what should we do about it? Our next guest offered some ideas during a recent presentation for the John Locke Foundation. It was dubbed a curbside chat. Bo Wright is development director for the group Strong Towns. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mitch. Thanks so much for having me here.
Before we talk about the decline or not of American cities, first of all, tell us, what is Strong Towns?
Yeah, so Strong Towns is now in its 10th year. We are a media organization that's looking into essentially the development pattern of America, the kind of connection between the ways that our cities develop, the physical layout of them, the roads, the sewers, what they look like, the streets, and the municipal finances of our cities. And so I might be jumping ahead, but with your question about decline in American cities, what we see is a lot of cities. And when we say cities, we basically mean municipalities. So that looks like counties. It's not just, don't think just the urban kind of inner core. We see a lot of municipalities really struggling with their finances. And a lot of that has to do with the way that we've built our cities. Basically, post-World War II, we've spread our cities out, and that has financial ramifications. And so our organization is dedicated to kind of exploring that connection and then providing resources to city leaders and engaged citizens across the country to make their towns and cities stronger.
So you mentioned that this really has a lot to do with the way the cities developed. What are the ways that they developed that have ended up being causing some perhaps unintended consequences or problems that people didn't foresee?
Yeah. So what we see is a lot of pre-World War II development. A lot of kind of urban thinkers will divide stuff into pre-World War II and post-World War II. Basically, pre-World War II, to make it really simple, we built our cities around the basically walking. We built it around walking from your home to a local shop. Whereas post-World War II, we built our cities around the automobile. And Strong Towns is pretty agnostic about, you know, where you live and stuff like that. But what we do is look at the math. And when we look at the math, we see that when you build a city or a community around the automobile, you end up spreading all of your infrastructure out, and it's very, very costly for municipalities. So, for example, one of the examples I shared in the presentation is Lafayette, Louisiana. So we have a lot of data on Lafayette, Louisiana, as well as other cities across the country. Lafayette in 1949 had something like 3 feet of pipe per person, whereas in 2015, they had 50 feet of pipe per person. And meanwhile, their population only grew basically three times. So what, if you're a city, what you should see when you look at that is your, you know, your income and your population growth grew three times, but your liabilities grew basically 50 times. And you simply can't do that. As a city, you can't spread out in that way and remain solvent. So we see a lot of cities that have developed in this way. And today they're really struggling because of kind of the obligations that they have with road maintenance liabilities and maintaining sewers and all of that kind of stuff.
That is the voice of Bo Wright. He is development director for the group Strong Towns. Bo, some people are going to hear us and they're going to say, wait a minute, these cities developed this way because this is the way people wanted to live. They wanted to have big houses and big yards and not be all crammed into one central location. Is it a problem that is based on the way people have chosen to live, or is there some other factor?
Totally. And this is why I mentioned before that Strong Towns is at least begins from a kind of perspective of being semi-agnostic about the development pattern. We didn't start as urban advocates or anything like that. I always point out, and I don't know if it's helpful or not, but Chuck Marone, who founded Strong Towns and has kind of been the voice in the face of our organization, when he started Strong Towns, he was living on 5 acres outside of town. And basically, he was a planner and engineer and realized that the way that we're building our towns and cities is making us poorer as communities. And I myself grew up kind of in a suburban, kind of rural area. And so I totally get the need for space. I'm someone who, you know, might always live in a single family home. That's just comfortable for me. But there's a guy here in North Carolina named Joe Minicozzi out of Asheville, North Carolina, who we work with a lot. And his response to this question is he's an Italian guy and he's bald and he's a short guy. And he said, yeah, I want to be 6'2 and have a full head of hair. But, you know, you can't – no one wants to pay for that for me. And so that's kind of the response is, yes, I totally get that. And we are not, you know – trying to bang people over the head and say you need to move within city limits, you can't have this. But we're trying to say there's a cost to this, and as a society, we need to pay for that cost, basically the cost to live so spread out.
Okay, so we have the situation of these cities that have been developed in these different ways and in ways that, from the vantage points of Strong Towns, are very costly.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do about it? We can't go back and say, all right, we're going to knock everything down and rebuild it. So how do we approach the issue?
Yeah. So there's a few things to say. One is, what can we learn from the past? What can we learn about the ways that we did build our towns and cities? One of the first things we'll notice when we do that is that prior to World War II, we built incrementally. We made small investments over a broad area over a long period of time. A lot of the development pattern we see today, in addition to being spread out, it's kind of developed all at once. So when we think of kind of a suburban neighborhood today, it's developed all at once to a finished state. And when it's finished, it's at its peak value, its peak prosperity, and then it simply declines from there. We see a lot of places struggling with that. So one of the things we can do is learn from the past and learn to build incrementally and bring some of those kind of insights into the way we build our towns and cities today. The other thing that Joe Minicozzi and our organization Strong Towns always points to is cities simply need to do the math. So they need to account for their expenses. To give just a very, very rough number, we've looked at in Lafayette, Louisiana, they decided that they needed $20 of private wealth created for every $1 of public investment. So if the city goes out and puts in a road that costs $100,000 for the asphalt, the sewers, the pipes, all of that stuff, you need about $2 million of private wealth generated as a result of that public investment. That goes to pay for the police and firefighters, you know, maintenance on all the stuff that it takes to make a city run. So cities need to do the math. What we see, what we saw in Lafayette, is $2 and $3 of public investment for every $1 of private investment. In a lot of the rural areas, we see $3 and $4 of public investment for every $1 of private investment. So municipalities simply need to do the math and account for their finances in the same way that like a business might do, the same way that we treat our kind of personal finances.
Another question people might have after listening to us is, okay, this all sounds kind of interesting. What's this going to mean in terms of, are we going to see higher taxes? Do we need more development restrictions? Are there policy recommendations that you all are making that would have that kind of basic impact on taxes or development rules or that sort of thing?
Yeah. The reality is we couldn't raise our taxes enough to pay for our backlog of maintenance liabilities in a lot of cities. That's simply not an option. In places where we've done that math, it would look like a 46% increase on taxes today with 3% increases over inflation. That's not going to happen. We're certainly not advocating for that to happen. But we do, we are not necessarily policy advocates. That's not our role. We want to kind of build a broad movement of people who are pushing for change. But we have had a number of elected officials, both at the mayor, the governor level, and recently some folks in Congress talking to us. And we have made a few policy recommendations that have to do with infrastructure, where that money should be spent, what kind of infrastructure actually has a return on investment.
Our guest has been Beau Wright, Development Director. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered. In print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. After less than 3 years on the job, UNC System President Margaret Spellings is leaving. Despite the unexpected early departure, Spellings told reporters she's proud of the university and her colleagues.
I'm proud of the work we have done and all that we have accomplished. Together, we have defied national trends on affordability and accountability. Together, we developed a muscular and measurable strategic plan with institution-specific performance agreements and publicly available dashboards that has created accountability and transparency and laid the foundation for years to come. Together, we put a lid on tuition, implementing NC Promise, implementing fixed tuition for students who are continuously enrolled, and passing 2 years of no tuition hikes for resident students. Together, we strengthened each of our institutions, raising enrollments, raising graduation rates, increasing completions for underserved groups, including low-income and rural students. We are graduating more students in critical workforce areas and increasing external research funding. Our state's confidence in this world-class system is clear. The General Assembly invested in us with the strongest budget in a decade, and taxpayers have invested in us through the Connect NC bond, the first buildings of which have now opened for students. All of this has happened over the past 3 years in the midst of a changing landscape buffeted by the urgent issues of the day. As a system, we have adapted and evolved to meet the times. We've elevated the system platform and rebranded as the unified statewide system that we are. And we've used our platform to better tell the story of our university. We've brought together thought leaders from across the state to connect the education continuum like never before. Initiatives like the My Future NC Commission, our teacher preparation efforts, and the Financial Aid Study Group are examples of the statewide coalition we have created. I came into the position intent on creating a culture of higher expectations, and that shift is underway. But times change, and those changes demand new leaders and new approaches. I will leave proud of the contributions made during my tenure and forever honored to have served. I've been blessed with the opportunity to travel this state and meet its best and brightest. This university is the state's most important asset, its mightiest engine.
That's UNC System President Margaret Spellings. She'll be leaving the job March 1st, 3 years after moving to North Carolina. The early departure comes with a separation package of more than $500,000. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Today's college students have embraced activism to an extent not seen since the 1970s. But William Dresewitz says there's something missing. The public intellectual and former Yale professor recently addressed the topic during a speech at Duke. He started by focusing on students' interest in doing good.
It's easy to know what you're against, a lot harder to come up with any kind of specific idea about what you want to put it in place. With, that is, a coherent vision of the social good rather than a bundle of slogans like overthrowing the patriarchy, or dismantling hierarchies of power. Or maybe it's not even that easy to know what you're against. I often hear people declare their opposition to capitalism, but the way they use the term suggests that they don't really know what capitalism is. They appear to equate it with greed, or inequality, or markets, or money, or having to work, all of which predate the emergence of capitalism by thousands of years and have been features of most, if not all, human society since the agricultural revolution. Nor do I hear any clear ideas, or for that matter, any ideas at all, about what we should put in place of capitalism. If you don't want capitalism, which let's define it briefly as the private ownership of production, the free market distribution of goods, and the cycle of investment and profit, if that's what capitalism is and you don't like it, so what do you want? State control of the economy, or centralized planning, or small-scale collectivism? Those are not rhetorical questions. I'm not saying any of those things are bad. These are real questions. The kinds of questions that need to be addressed if you really want to bring about the end of capitalism. What comes afterwards?
The debate about capitalism is just an example for Dresewitz.
The larger point is that when you commit yourself to the good, to making the world a better place, you need to commit yourself, first of all, not to action at all, but to something else, something that must precede action, something called reflection or contemplation or analysis or study. In a word, you must commit yourself to thought. Yet that is precisely what I find to be lacking today in progressive circles, no less than anywhere else, not just on campuses, but everywhere. Nobody wants to think. Certainly, nobody wants to think about their own beliefs, values, and assumptions. Now, this is always a problem everywhere. Nobody ever wants to think about their beliefs, values, and assumptions. It's too much trouble, and it's much too troubling. Asking people to think about their beliefs, values, and assumptions is what Plato's teacher Socrates went around Athens doing until his fellow citizens decided they were sick of hearing him, and they said, here, drink this hemlock. But I also believe that the problem is especially acute today, particularly for young people, more particularly for progressive college students, most particularly for progressive students at elite private colleges. In other words, people exactly like you. That's because we live at a time when progressive opinion is hardened into something approaching religious dogma. There's a right way to think, and a right way to talk, and a right set of things to think and talk about. Secularism is taken for granted. Environmentalism is a sacred cause. Issues of identity, particularly the holy trinity of race, gender, and sexuality, occupy the center of the discourse. The assumption on the left is that we are already in full possession of the moral truth. The fact that this may also be the assumption on the right is neither here nor there. The point is what's happening on the left, on my side and probably on the side that most of you identify with. We supposedly already know, what's good, what's bad, what's right, what's wrong. There's really nothing to discuss. We just need to talk about the best way to put our beliefs into practice.
That's the voice of public intellectual William Dresiewicz, speaking recently at Duke University. He explained how a college campus can reinforce conformity to a single viewpoint.
They are the kind of institutions that sociologists call total institutions, places that subsume the totality of their members' lives, like prisons, monasteries, mental hospitals, or the military, for interesting analogies to the college experience. The social cost of dissent is correspondingly higher. The progressive ideological consensus is correspondingly tighter. And I'm sure I don't need to explain that to you either. In fact, we had a conversation about this in a class this morning. Certainly not given everything I'd already heard even before I got here on elite private college campuses, and I spent time at a lot of them. Students seldom disagree with one another anymore in class, so I've been told about school after school. And the reason, said one of the students I talked to at a liberal arts college in the Northwest, is mainly that they really don't have any disagreements. Another added that when they take up an issue in class, it's not let's talk about issue X, but let's talk about why such and such a position is the correct one to have on issue X. A third student at a selective women's college in Southern California told me that the first thing she learned to do when she got to college was to keep quiet about her Christian faith and her non-feminist views about marriage, which were informed by her Christian faith. A fourth informed me that he's careful when questioning consensus beliefs to phrase his opinion in terms of, explain to me why I'm wrong. Still others have told me that any challenge to the reigning dogma will get you branded as a racist, as in, don't talk to that guy, he's a racist.
The antidote? Dresiewicz says students need to learn how to think. Their classes should force them to engage with topics that have no easy answers.
Now, if that sounds really hard, it's because it is really hard, and it's supposed to be really hard. And if you're taking a class, for example, that isn't hard, you're cheating yourself. It would be like if the football coach only made you practice twice a week. It would be a lot easier, but you would be very good, and you'd lose all your games. In fact, what happens in a good course is directly connected to learning how to make arguments. Like, that's what writing papers are for. You write a paper that makes an argument, and then your teacher goes through it point by point, identifying errors in logic, faults in structure, problems with the way you handled evidence, opportunities you missed, places where objections should have been anticipated. She also raises further questions, suggests additional lines of inquiry, and commends the ways in which you did things right. By the way, that teaching thing is very, very labor intensive. I'm not going to address myself to the deans in the audience, but this is why the whole set of priorities with which we hire, promote, and reward faculty is so deeply screwed up. Because in research universities, teaching is actively disincentivized, whereas good teaching, even if you're already a good teacher, is extremely labor-intensive.
Dresiewicz says it takes more than just one tough class to help hone a student's thinking skills.
And you don't just go through this once, right? You go through this again and again and again in class after class after class. You write a 3-page essay your first week of freshman year, and then maybe you write some 15-page seminars when you're a junior, and then hopefully you have some capstone paper, senior essay, 50, 80 pages. Or if you're a science major, you go through the analogous process with lab reports or computer programs or mathematical proofs. You're learning how to think. And even 4 years is barely enough to make a decent start.
That's why college marks just one step in the pursuit of wisdom. That's according to William Dresiewicz, recent speaker at Duke University. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered, in print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina has received federal approval to transition to a cost-saving whole health Medicaid managed care system. That's a system that will take the state out of the day-to-day management of the government insurance program, which helps the elderly, the disabled, and the poor. Dan Way covers health care for Carolina Journal. He joins us now to talk about the import of this green light from the feds. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna. Pleased to be here.
Help us understand the program in general. How many people are covered, and how does it work funding-wise?
There are 2 million people, roughly, in North Carolina who are covered under Medicaid and NC Health Choice. It's a joint program with the federal government. The federal government pays the bulk of the money, but the state does allocate substantial resources.
That's 1 out of 5 people. That's a huge government program to provide health care, medical care to people.
Well, it's an enormous outlay, and that's why it gets so much attention among the lawmakers and the policymakers.
Now, the state of North Carolina applied for a waiver, and since the federal government helps fund this program, you have to get permission from them in order to make any substantive changes to how this operates, correct?
Right. It's called a demonstration waiver, and that was filed last year.
So, what was the request that North Carolina submitted and that has now been approved?
Well, they're going to completely revamp the program. They're calling it the biggest change in Medicaid in North Carolina in 40 years. So they're going to be moving from a state day-to-day management of the program to contracting it out to 4 statewide entities and 12 regional entities. There'll be commercial plans. Big insurance companies will probably get a lot of the statewide contract attention. And then doctor-led, hospital-led, local, regional providers can also apply for more regional plans.
Help us understand a little bit more about that. So you're saying the state would get out of the day-to-day operation. What is it that the state is doing now that it won't be doing?
Well, all of the services that are provided will be managed and looked at by these entities rather than the state having to have their people doing that. So they'll be contracting with the state to under what's called a capitated program rather than paying a fee for service for every treatment, every service that a patient gets. These providers, these networks will get a flat fee per patient, and they'll have to manage that care under a case management program for that allotment.
Some of our listeners might be saying, well, hey, wait a second. That sounds like they're going to be given a certain amount of money, but what about the quality of care? As it is right now, if someone is covered by Medicaid and they go see a doctor, whatever service that doctor provides, that doctor bills Medicaid for and they're reimbursed. But you're saying that instead of that, that the doctors or the groups of doctors would be given a flat amount of money for each patient, and then they need to manage that person's care with that money?
Right. So they're completely redirecting how the program works. So
that's a big change.
It's a huge change. And what's going to happen is that these providers will be they'll have contracts that have metrics in there. So they're going to look at quality of care and health-based outcomes rather than volume of service. So that, you know, you could go to the doctor many times but not actually have good health outcomes. Now they're going to be accountable, more accountable. So the state will say, okay, here's part of your contract. We need to see these kinds of advances, these kinds of outcomes, this level of quality. And if you don't meet that, well, your contract could be changed or even rescinded.
It sounds like a really common sense reform that really focuses in on making sure that people are getting the care that they need versus just test after test or visit after visit. But I would suspect, Dan, that some people will be saying, but what is the accountability measure there for someone? If you're seeing a doctor, what if you feel like you're not getting the care that you need? There must be some sort of mechanism in place to make sure that the quality of care at the very least doesn't decrease, but hopefully would increase.
Right. And a lot of these metrics are still being worked on. There's still hundreds of pieces to this puzzle that are being put together. The state opened the bids from the vendors just this month. They'll be awarding contracts in February. In between now and then, they'll be looking at some of these items that you're mentioning, trying to get the best kind of plan that they can in place.
How does the cost savings come into effect here?
Well, if you recall, in 2013, there was a blistering state audit that showed the Medicaid program was in complete chaos. They had run up $2 billion worth of cost overruns in 4 years.
This was happening year after year. It was
right.
You were writing about this for a number of years, but it just kept going over budget and over budget.
Right. So when the McCrory administration came in, they said, hey, this has to stop. And they put forth the first plan, the first iteration of this reform. And as it progressed in 2015, they settled on the current plan. They started working towards what now has been approved by the federal government. So those state savings, actually the Medicaid program has shown surpluses the last couple of years. So they've completely overhauled the program to great success. And it's helped not have these pressures on other state agencies to give up money at the end of the year when they find out Medicaid has, busted their budget.
Interesting that as you look back at the previous years, the McCrory administration was working on this. That was a Republican governor. We now have a Democrat governor in Roy Cooper. So does that mean that there is a bipartisan view that something had to change with Medicaid?
Well, they're kind of on different sides of the fence in many ways. If you'll recall, the Cooper administration tried to expand Medicaid without authorization from the legislature as soon as the governor took office. Their push has been to expand Medicaid. The General Assembly's view, the Republicans, are more on a page where they want to make sure everything in Medicaid is running smoothly before they consider any expansion. And just by the size of the populations, the program has been expanding anyhow. It's not like it's a static number.
Because more people are moving to North Carolina.
Right. And population's growing. And
What has been the reaction by doctors and hospitals to this sort of change, and the news that the feds have indeed approved the waiver to go forward with this?
Well, there's been a lot of wariness on the medical profession up to this point. I think now some of them are looking at this more of a, well, let's see how it works. Let's see what networks we can get into. So I think there's more of a willingness to take part now. It's just, you know, these big entities are going to have to start assuming some of these doctors into their networks to provide what the patients need.
Dan, is this essentially a one-and-done reform, or is this considered a first step towards other reforms that could potentially take place?
Well, this particular program now will be phased in over 3 years. So the first allotment is going to be a $6 billion procurement for some of these services. It's the largest in state history. So even with this first demonstration model, there will be some phases. And, you know, depending how everything works, there could be more changes down the road.
We've been talking with Dan Way. He covers healthcare for Carolina Journal, where he is an associate editor. You can read Dan's work on this at carolinajournal.com. Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.